This time on your weekly constitutional, you've heard of Selma, you've heard of Little Rock, but have you heard of Clinton?
This Green McAdoo Cultural Center is a museum to commemorate the history of the first public school desegregation in the South after Brown versus Board of Education. The United States Supreme Court went from separate but equal in 1896 to separate is inherently unequal in 1954.
That was Jerry Shattuck of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center in Clinton, Tennessee. He's going to tell us a tale of a school desegregation that started out well, but then went off the tracks. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's your weekly constitutional.
Stay tuned for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
You're in for a real treat today because we're going to tell you a tale of kindness and of hatred, of drama and suspense. And the fellow who's going to tell it to you lived through it himself.
Well, my name is Jerry Shattuck. I'm a retired attorney. I practiced law here in Clinton for a little over 40 years. And during that period of time, I did become involved in the later years in the development of this Green McAdoo Cultural Center, which is a museum to commemorate the history of the first public school desegregation in the South after Brown versus Board of Education.
The very first.
That's correct.
Well, tell me more. What happened here?
Well, I better correct myself. My friends from Oak Ridge might get unhappy.
Oh, okay.
Actually, a year before, Oak Ridge High School did desegregate, but it was not the result of court action, and at that time, Oak Ridge was still a federal reservation under the exclusive jurisdiction of the Atomic Energy Commission.
Right, and rather a special place.
Very much so, a special place, the home of the Manhattan Project, which resulted in the ending of World War II. But at any rate, we were still the first public school to desegregate under the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And as I'm sure your listeners already know, the United States Supreme Court went from separate but equal in 1896 to separate is inherently unequal in 1954. And in the meantime, of course, we had the Jim Crow era in the South, where everything was segregated under court approval, because the United States Supreme Court held in 1896 that separation of the races is legal and constitutional.
That was the Plessy versus Ferguson case, considered by many to be the second worst case in all of Supreme Court history after Dred Scott.
All right. At any rate, under the decision, that more or less sanctified the segregation. You know, as long as the facilities in which the races are separated are equal, it's okay. And under that situation, we had the Jim Crow era in the South, segregated everything, segregated parks, swimming pools, cafes, restaurants, pool halls, anything you might want to say, water fountains, restrooms, and most significantly, of course, segregated schools. And here in Clinton, Tennessee, segregated schools took the following form. The black children, grades 1 through 8, were educated in a two-room schoolhouse. And there were almost 60 of those children, grades 1 through 8, in that two-room schoolhouse.
And wait a minute, 60 children in two rooms.
That's correct. Separate but hardly equal.
In fact, I'll note that we're sitting in that very building right now in a tiny, tiny little room. And you told me just before we sat down what this room was.
Yes, it was the principal's office and the library.
And this is no more than 10 or 15 feet long and maybe 6 or 7 feet wide.
That's correct, with bookshelves on either end, which held the so-called library that was available. And, of course, it was also where the principal brought the children to get their spankings,
right,
their paddlings, too.
Right.
His picture's on the front of the building out there with these 60 children, and you look at him, you can understand how he maintained order.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, these children, when they finished the 8th grade, high school is next, and Clinton High School was at that time just about 200 yards down the hill from this building. But under the Jim Crow segregation situation that existed, those children were not allowed to go to that high school. Instead, they were bused almost 20 miles to a segregated high school in Knoxville, the old Austin High School. And it was that situation that the black parents contested with the help of the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall, who was the lead attorney in their case. They filed a lawsuit in federal court in Knoxville complaining about this out-of-town arrangement.
And what year was that?
1950.
So this was before Brown versus Board.
It was a year before Brown versus Board was filed in Topeka, Kansas.
Oh, my.
Yes. And, of course, Anderson County, as the defendant, presented its case under the separate but equal doctrine that was the law at that time. And the proof presented was that Austin High School, that segregated black high school in Knoxville, was equal to, arguably superior, to Clinton High School, with a better physical facility, a broader academic and vocational curriculum.
Was that true?
Yes, that was true. I mean, it was proof offered in federal court in front of Judge Taylor, who had the reputation of not putting up with foolishness. No, those were factual matters of evidence.
Strange as it sounds to modern ears, separate but equal was the law of the land. So really all you had to prove if you were separate was that you were equal.
That's correct.
And they managed to do that here in Knoxville, here in Clinton.
That's correct. And that case was on appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. And somehow Brown versus Board and some other cases too, I think, got to the Supreme Court before the Anderson County case or the Clinton case. And the Supreme Court, as you know, in 1954, abolished the separate but equal doctrine, stating authoritatively that separate is inherently unequal, mm-hmm. and therefore violates the rights of black children under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Well, based on that new law, of course, the Clinton case was sent back to Judge Taylor in Knoxville. The next year, in 1955, the Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board 2.
Right.
And that's where they came out with this statement that, last year we abolished the separate but equal doctrine. Now, how are we going to enforce it? And they came out with this oxymoron, with all deliberate speed. Well, those deliberate is slow and careful, and speed is just the opposite. And, of course, school districts throughout the South seized on the deliberate and in some cases held off desegregation till the early 70s. But Judge Taylor, the federal district judge in Knoxville, he was a speed man. When cases came before him, he decided them very quickly and authoritatively. And of course, when the Clinton case was sent back to him after Brown versus Board and Brown versus Board 2, he immediately decided and ordered that Clinton High School would be desegregated in the fall of 1956.
That is a remarkable series of events.
Yes.
And you're right, Judge Taylor was that rare Southern judge that moved with alacrity on desegregation.
That's correct, and I'm sure there were others too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hate to lump
sure.
too many people in too simple a category,
mm-hmm.
but I think there were others throughout the South also. But at any rate, you know, here we are in Clinton, home of the first public school in the South to desegregate. And at that time, Clinton was a small town, about 4,000 people, but a very close-knit community filled with people who considered themselves to be good, decent, law-abiding citizens. So when we were confronted with this decision by Judge Taylor in the United States Supreme Court, we had to undergo a process of thought. And the consensus was reached that, all right, you know, we're a community of good, decent, law-abiding citizens. We're going to abide by the law of the land. And it was a pretty easy decision because I shouldn't say this probably, but segregation in Clinton, Tennessee, at that time was probably as benign as segregation could be compared to a lot of other communities throughout the South. I mean, everything was segregated, but relationships between whites and blacks in this town had always been very harmonious under that segregated system.
No, I think that's a valid point, Jerry. I will often point out to my students that slavery and Jim Crow were terrible situations, but there were degrees. I mean, there were some places where it was much worse than others and some places where it was relatively good. So it was relatively good here.
At any rate, and of course, you know, black and white children had contact. I mean, we played street basketball with black kids and
you were here during that time. How old were you when this was going on, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, I lived here since I was in the third grade.
Right.
I was 16.
So you were very cognizant of what was going on.
Yeah. At any rate, the community, and it was talked about in school and in the churches and in the local newspaper, and generally speaking, a consensus was reached. We're good, decent, law-abiding people. We're going to abide by the law of the land. Now, there's rich irony there. Mm-hmm. We were good, decent, law-abiding people back before, mm-hmm. when the law was separate but equal. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, there was some growth in there to make the transition to the new situation and the new law that we were going to abide by. But at any rate, that consensus was reached, and I think it was a 90% consensus, basically, in the community. And notice, you know, agreeing to abide by the law of the land is relatively passive. It's a far cry from a personal realization of and a personal commitment to the justice of desegregation. That knowledge and that commitment comes to different people at different times throughout a process such as this. But with that lowest common denominator approach, everybody was willing to accept the situation and abide by the law of the land. And that was basically how we entered that school year. And registration day came and went, no problems. The black kids came down, registered for school. School was out for about a week while teachers had in-service training. And we were to start classes the next Monday. Well, in the meantime, national newspapers, coast to coast, were running stories about this little old town in this East Tennessee that was going to have the first desegregated public school. And you got to realize, say what you will, this was probably the greatest social and cultural revolution of the 20th century.
It probably was.
At any rate, we were a subject of national news. And a fellow by the name of John Casper was head of the Seaboard White Citizens Council in Washington, D.C.
The Seaboard White Citizens Council. There
Correct.
Were a lot of organizations like that, weren't
right.
there?
A lot of white citizens councils.
Right.
At any rate, he read about the Clinton situation. I think it was in a Richmond newspaper. And he decided to get down here. He drove down here immediately and got here, I think, Friday or Saturday before the Monday that school was to start. And he started walking up and down the street and going to residential areas, knocking on doors, passing out hate literature, which I'm sure people listening have seen and heard of. Didn't have much success. That first Monday morning, he had maybe 10 to 20 picketers out in front of the school to protest the desegregation. And let's face it, in a little old town like Clint, Tennessee, protests of that nature are pretty rare. And those folks were gone in 30 minutes to an hour. But along with those few protesters, we have almost 100 media here. The New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Life
right.
Magazine, Time Magazine, even the London Times had a reporter here.
All the way from England.
That's correct.
Oh, my. And this was big news.
NBC, TV crews, CBS. Yes, we had television back then. It was black and white. Right. But that afternoon, one of the Knoxville papers came out in the afternoons, and it came out that afternoon, and the headline was, Clinton High Integrated Without Fuss. And that was the truth. But that night on the nightly news, coast to coast, the lead story was about this protest in Clinton. And so as a result of that publicity, the next morning, and these numbers are almost literal, we had about 15 people protesting.
Right.
They stayed a little longer. More publicity. The next morning, 50. The next morning, 500. And by Friday night, there were 2,000 people in that town square.
Today on See It Now, here is Edward R. Murrow.
We call this report Clinton and the Law.
Of the 4,000 people who live in Clinton, more than 3,700 are white. And by tradition and custom, most of them believe in separate schools. In 1950, Negro parents, backed by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, brought suit against the Anderson County school system, which administers Clinton High School, asking that their children be admitted. The federal judge in this section of Tennessee in 1951 and now is Robert L. Taylor of Knoxville.
At that time, I held that the colored children were not entitled to enter the Clinton High School.
When the Supreme Court decision of May 1954 ruled against segregation, Judge Taylor's ruling was reversed.
Desegregation in that county should be effective not later than the beginning of the fall term of 1956.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're hearing the fascinating tale of the integration of Clinton High School, the first school to integrate after Brown versus Board of Education. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm hearing a fascinating story from Jerry Shattuck of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center in Clinton, Tennessee, where a full year before Little Rock, the high school was desegregated.
Like I say, by Friday night, there were 2,000 people in that town square down there, in front of the courthouse. This town was inundated with cars from Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina. Earlier in the week, this guy, John Casper, had been joined by a man from Alabama named Asa Carter. He was head of the Northeast Alabama White Citizens Council. His earlier claim to fame had been that he and some of his cronies had attacked Nat King Cole when he was performing on stage in Birmingham. But he joined Casper, and he was very charismatic, too. And they organized a local White Citizens Council, got about 100 people to join or so. And at night, they would go out in the county, and they'd hold a rally, and they'd burn a cross and rant and rave about the Supreme Court. And tell the crowd, the Supreme Court does not tell us the law of the land. The law of the land is the will of the people. And the will of the people in Anderson County, Tennessee, is they don't want their kids going to school with niggers.
Oh, my.
And everybody would rant and rave, yay, yay, and they'd burn another cross.
Right.
And the next morning, they'd show up at school. As you walk to school, you get spit on, called names. That was for the white kids.
Wait a second.
Yes.
White kids are getting spit on by other white citizens in their citizens' councils because you were willing to be desegregated?
Apparently so. But that was nothing. The black children, the Clinton 12,
right,
would meet right up here in this building at their old grammar school.
Right.
And as a group, they'd walk down that hill, and this mob would be on either side of the street, cursing and hollering and spitting and throwing things. Those children, the Clinton 12, literally had to run a gauntlet to get an education in their hometown. That's how bad the situation was.
And this was mostly outsiders.
Without question, I'm just going to say at least 90%.
Really?
Now, there were some Clinton people in that mob, too. Don't
sure.
get me wrong. But I don't think they would have ever showed up without all that outside agitation that we received. No, it was 90% out-of-towners. You got to remember, back then, we didn't have the interstate system.
Right.
Clinton was just like every other small town in America. The main street was the main route. You can imagine the local authorities were kept becoming more and more concerned because we not only had this situation with the kids going to school, but at night, there were crosses being burned in the yards of school teachers, school board members, city officials. The children, some of the black parents up here on the hill where most of the black population existed or congregated, were even taking their children to Mount Sinai Church to spend the night in the basement for fear of what was going on down the hill in the middle of town. It was a bad, bad situation. And of course, the local authorities had stayed in touch with Governor Frank Clement, not knowing when they might need help. But at the same time, having an ever-growing situation. So the local authorities, and by the way, at that time, Clinton's police force numbered a total of about six. There's no way they could control a mob of 2,000. So the local authorities established a home guard, just everyday citizens, plant workers, mill workers, some lawyers, my football coach, just everyday people who were deputized and armed to help the police control this mob.
It's like calling up the militia.
Well, it was the home guard, just everyday people, citizens. And so that Saturday night, and incidentally, that crowd had grown to about 3,000 by Saturday night. The home guard was trying to keep the street open for traffic. I forgot to tell you earlier on during that week, cars coming through with black occupants, that mob would jump those cars and rock them, smash out windows. You can see pictures of it from Life magazine in the exhibit room in there in this museum. But it was a bad situation. So that Saturday night, the home guard tried to clear the mob. and they formed a phalanx, a line, and marched across the courthouse lawn to disperse that mob. And the mob did retreat, but they regrouped and they reformed, and they said, let's charge them. They charged the Home Guard. The Home Guard threw tear gas. The mob retreated again and said, let's attack them. Let's take their guns from them and kill them. And this was the few expletives in there also. And they were just starting that charge when suddenly about 60 highway patrol cars came across the bridge from Knoxville, came down Main Street, circled the courthouse square, and the lead car stopped after it completed the circle in front of the courthouse. And the head of the highway patrol at that time was a man by the name of Greg O'Rear. Greg O'Rear was 6 feet eight, which today, 6 feet eight is no big deal.
Wait a second. This is like John Wayne showing up with the cavalry
absolutely.
At the last possible. This is like an old-fashioned Western.
Exactly. It really was.
I was going to ask you where the state people were, so I guess eventually they decided to show.
Well, the governor's office and the local authorities had stayed in communication, but obviously the governor didn't want to send in the highway patrol or the National Guard until it was absolutely necessary. And by that Saturday night, it was absolutely necessary. So when old Greg O'Rear parked that lead car in front of the courthouse there, as I said earlier, he was 6 feet eight, which today that's no big deal. A lot of high school kids are 6 feet eight. But back in the 50s, 6 feet eight was almost unheard of. Well, he clambered out of that patrol car sort of in pieces because he was so big.
Right.
And he finally stood up to his full height and he threw that shotgun over his shoulder. And he said, boys, it's all over. And it was. That night, the highway patrol put the town under martial law. The next morning, the National Guard was here. We had platoons marching past the high school, tanks rumbling around town.
Tanks?
Yes, sir.
My goodness.
We'll show you some pictures in there later on. But we were under martial law for about a three-week period then. Well, everything had calmed down, obviously. In the meantime, though, this little Home Guard that Casper and Asa Carter had organized started a little weekly local newspaper. They tried to organize a boycott of businesses whose owners they thought were supportive of desegregation. We had more dynamite sticks going off.
More dynamite sticks?
Yes.
Wait, back up here. Tell me about the dynamite.
Well, that first week we'd had crosses being burned and dynamite sticks going off.
Seriously?
Yes, sir. But now that in that interim, we had more of the dynamite sticks.
And they were just doing it to make noise? They weren't actually bombing buildings?
Well, there was some property damage here on the hill where, again, most of the black population lived. There was a store in a home that had a stash of dynamite blowing up, resulting in some property damage and some shards of glass had cut one of the residents of a home. But that was the extent of, you know, relatively small property damage. But you can imagine with this going on, you know, an aura of fear and intimidation grows. And then in November, the local authorities made a big mistake. Back during that first week of mob violence that I just described, the local authorities had arrested Casper and charged him with incitement to riot. Well, they decided to bring him back in town and try him on those misdemeanor charges. So he showed up with three attorneys, and they turned a little misdemeanor case into a circus. They demanded a jury. The case went on for about a week. They had to continue it to finish it. In the meantime, finally, the jury acquitted Casper. Mm. And Simon Wright's hard to prove, believe it or not. At any rate, he was acquitted, and we were in the national news again, and the mob reformed again.
Let me inject a little bit of constitutional law here. Incitement to riot is one of the few exceptions to the protections of the free speech clause of the First Amendment.
Right.
If you go out there and you actually encourage people to engage in illegal conduct, then you can be arrested for that. At that point, if you presented a clear and present danger of endangering the public. And it sounds to me like this guy was guilty.
The proof was presented, and there was no direct proof of direct words to commit an illegal act. I mean, it was very vague.
So somebody was urging those people to charge to the cops, and somebody was urging them to take their guns, and somebody was urging them to kill them with it, but they couldn't prove that it was Asa.
That's right, or John Casper.
Excuse me, John Casper, I meant.
Right. That's correct. I mean, it was
okay. That's understandable.
It was presented as a spontaneous,
right,
exhibition of political sentiment or what have you.
There you go.
They were very difficult to get specific proof of words that incited an illegal act. Okay. At any rate, Casper was acquitted, and that hit the national news. And as a result, the mob reformed. It wasn't as large as time, only about 500. But in the meantime, the White Citizens Council had organized a White Citizens Youth Council made up of some kids in the high school who were children of council members.
And to reiterate, you were at the high school at this time.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so you were right in the middle of all that, this.
Well, yes, all of us were. And this, it was harassment of the black students, thumbtacks in seats, ink in lockers, jostling in the hallways, that sort of thing. The principal organized the football team so that there were some of us at every hallway intersection during class breaks. And with his work and the work of the teachers and us, that was over in 2 days and didn't happen anymore. But again, it hit the press and helped reinvigorate a mob mentality. And the mob did reform. It wasn't as big as before, only about 500, but we had it. And there was trouble, noise, protest. The black parents, with this John Casper acquittal, the dynamite sticks going off, the trouble in the school, became more and more concerned about the safety of their children. So they kept them out of school for about 2 days, wanting a guarantee of safety for their children. So I think it was on the third day, the minister of the First Baptist Church, the white minister, came up here to this school and walked and escorted the black students down the hill to Clinton High School.
That was a brave act, and also I'm sure his authority. I mean, these are the same kids who saw him on Sundays.
They didn't. It was a white.
No, excuse me, that's what I'm saying. The white kids would see him
that's
on
correct.
Sundays, and so he was a big authority figure for them.
That's correct. But again, it wasn't the kids that were the problem. When he walked, after he delivered those children to school, he was walking back to his church, and part of this mob peeled off. And they finally got him cornered up near Main Street and gave him a severe beating.
They beat the local Baptist
they beat
minister.
The local Baptist minister.
Oh, my.
I mean, he was just a bloody pulp. Now, he really wasn't hurt, thank God. He went into a doctor's office, got cleaned up, and there's a picture of him in there in the exhibit room going into the police station to help with the investigation of the guys that were arrested for beating him. But that same day, apparently emboldened by their attack on Reverend Turner, mob tried to break into the school. They were intercepted by the home economics teacher, who happened to be the principal's wife. And she was a very sweet, lovely, but small, frail lady. Well, they slammed her up against the wall and kept coming. Well, here's the side story. You know, I was a football player, right?
Right.
Tough guy, right?
Right.
And those boys play in a band, just a bunch of sissies, right? Well, you know who ran him out of there? The lead trumpet in the band.
Really?
He came around a corner and saw what was happening. He hollered at him and started running toward him, and they all took off out the door.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I grew up a whole lot that one morning.
Good for him. What was his name?
His name was Dennis Holland.
Right.
Dennis Holland.
Well, good for Dennis.
He was a real hero.
Absolutely.
Let me tell you more of that side story.
Yeah.
He started getting anonymous phone calls at home threatening him and his family. And it was so bad that his mother and father decided to send him to Florida to finish his high school year because they had a brother that lived down there.
Hmm.
I mean, imagine that.
Yeah.
All right. So now what I've told you, the mob violence, the Reverend Turner beating, this mob violence, all happened the same day.
Hmm.
Well, after the mob tried to break into school, the principal was very concerned. Obviously, it hit pretty close to home. He sent word to Judge Taylor that he needed help again. And Judge Taylor sent federal marshals over here who arrested about 16 people, all of whom served some time for their activities that day. That same day, Clinton was having a municipal election.
It's election day.
And the White Citizens Council had run a candidate for mayor and a couple for city council. Well, you know, small town. We all know about Facebook and media today. And the Reverend Turner's beating, the mob trying to break into school, the principal closing the school down. People heard about that just in a flash.
Small town grapevine is just as fast as Facebook, yeah.
Exactly. So on that election day, more people turned out than ever had before or since and voted and overwhelmingly defeated those white citizens' council candidates. And all that happened in one day.
What was the day?
December the 3rd, 1956. But that was the end of the trouble that first year. That spring, Bobby Kane, the first black to graduate from a desegregated public school in the South, received his diploma. We went through the next year of desegregation, no problems. Started the third year of desegregation, no problems, until suddenly one Sunday morning, October the 5th, 1958, the high school was blown up.
Blown up?
Dynamited to the ground.
To the ground?
Exactly.
Not just one stick in a corner, the whole thing.
There were a series of three explosions in three different sections of the building. And I can remember being away in school and picking up a New York paper. There on the front page is a half a page, a picture of my high school in rubble. I mean, it's just
amazing. Did you hear the explosion go off?
No, I was up north in college at the time.
Okay, you'd already graduated by then. Of course you had. It was 3 years later.
Right.
Of course.
At any rate, this is another amazing story. Oak Ridge was still a federal reservation. And after the Manhattan Project had wound down, Oak Ridge had lost a lot of population. So the Atomic Energy Commission, which owned everything in Oak Ridge, all the homes, all the commercial buildings, all the schools, had an abandoned elementary school. And they made that building available to the Anderson County School System as a replacement for Clinton, temporary replacement for Clinton High School.
How far is Oak Ridge from here?
About 7 miles.
Okay, so they could bus over there pretty easily.
That's correct. And so that school had been abandoned for years. It had to be cleaned, painted, furnished, equipped. People turned out from Oak Ridge and Clinton and all over Anderson County with mops and brooms and tools and lumber and pickup trucks to get that school ready. And on the appointed morning, the kids are all bused from outlying areas of the county to the bombed out Clinton High School here in Clinton. And the kids, the Clinton kids, get on the buses with their county fellow students and they caravan down to Oak Ridge to their new school. Satellite. You know, Oak Ridge and Clinton were big rivals in football and basketball, traditional, a big deal, you know. We beat them about once every decade in football.
Reminds me of my high school, but go on, please.
Well, when we beat them that once every decade, it's a big deal. But at any rate, when they get there, start off their buses, there's the Oak Ridge High School band in full uniform and formation. They play the Clinton High School alma mater. As the Clinton kids, black and white, get off their buses and go into their new school.
You're bringing tears to my eyes, Jerry.
Well, here's the kicker. The high school was bombed on a Sunday morning. Those kids were back in school on Thursday. I mean, it's an amazing logistical accomplishment. And why do I say all this? Well, as you might imagine, I'm from Clinton, and I'm biased, and I'm prejudiced about Clinton. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to tell you an untruth about it. Because, you know, we had that mob violence that first week. And you're sitting there, you know, you grow up in a little town. You know everybody, and everybody knows you, and you like everybody, more or less.
More or less.
And, you know, it's just, you want it to look good to the rest of the nation, right? And here that first week in September of 1956, we had that awful mob violence. But what was the town's reaction? Formed a home guard. Can you imagine a more heroic example of citizenship?
No.
Than to be deputized to go out there and confront an irate mob of 3,000? It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
And then later on, October 58, your high school is blown up, but the town pulls together with the rest of the county in Oak Ridge, and the kids are back in school in 3 days. So these terrible things that happen are terrible, reprehensible. But even more important is what's the community's reaction to those events. Yep. And on that front, I think Clinton fares extremely well.
I think you're exactly right.
But that, in a nutshell, is what happened in Clinton. And that's a very sparse outline of what happened here. But it's a true story. And it's commemorated here in this museum, which we certainly hope anybody that's ever in this area will come and see it.
Well, anybody anywhere. This is a story of international significance. So,
well, and it was. I mean, these events were covered in the foreign press.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, I can remember when Casper that first week was here exhorting the mob. That week, the Daily Worker, which was the communist newspaper in New York City, came out with an article praising the people of Clinton. You know,
that's a rarity, yeah.
For their reaction to desegregation. And of course, Casper, who'd been preaching all along that this desegregation is another communist conspiracy, he seized on that Daily Worker article. I told you so.
Right.
Communist inspired.
On August 20, 1956, approximately 700 students registered for the fall opening without incident. John Casper, an outsider, a white supremacist, told them that the law need not be obeyed.
Our failure to date has been failing to attack. But we in the White Citizens Council say now, yesterday, today, and forever, as long as there is one living white man in the United States, the Supreme Court is not the law of the land. That decision is not the law of the land now, or it never will be. Never.
This is Jerry Shattuck, captain of the football team and an all-state guard.
Of course, we knew we would have Negro students in school with us when we started, but no one said too much about it, and no one seemed opposed to it violently. Then, I believe it was the Saturday before the Monday that school started, this Casper came into town trying to form pickets in front of school for Monday morning. And then Monday morning when we did come to school, we found that there were 15 to 20 people out there with picket. All the trouble seemed to be outside the school among the adults and, well, I'd say six or seven of the students that Casper had persuaded to picket.
It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're hearing the story of the integration of Clinton High School in tiny Clinton, Tennessee, just north of Knoxville, which happened a full year before Little Rock. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Jerry Shattuck of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center in Clinton, Tennessee. Jerry's been telling us a tale that started out well, got very, very bad, but that ended on a very hopeful note. Now let's find out what happened in the aftermath. Once all the brouhaha died down, how long was it before people started talking about commemorating it with this center? I mean, was this school building right here continued to function as a school for a while, did it?
For a short period of time until the elementary schools were desegregated also. Okay. After that, it was a Head Start center, and then a daycare center, and then a warehouse, and then it was starting to fall down, and the city was... We were thinking about destroying the building. And the black community suggested that we not destroy it, that we try to create a museum to commemorate that desegregation history. Right. We just thought, that's a great idea. So we undertook that process, which is a long, drawn-out process, of course. And at first, we were going to do it ourselves. And it would have ended up looking like an exhibit at the county fair or something. We had a very innovative city manager at that time, a gentleman by the name of Steve Jones, who, incidentally, the principal of the high school back in 1956 was his uncle.
Oh, my.
Small town.
Small town.
At any rate, he knew Congressman Zach Womp, you know, who used to represent this district from Chattanooga. So he went to see Zach Womp in Washington, and he showed him the Life magazines that had featured this story. Both the first week and during the bombing and so forth. And Zach Womp said, this is amazing. I never know about this. So let's go down the hall and talk to John Lewis. Mm-hmm. So they go down the hall and talk to John Lewis.
And of course, he's a famous civil rights leader.
Exactly. Well, here's Zach Womp. You know, he's a conservative Republican. and John Lewis, a very liberal Democrat. But back then, you know, those congressmen did talk to each other.
What a concept.
You know?
Yeah, what a concept.
It wasn't that long ago, 2006, 2005. So John Lewis and Zach Womp and Steve are going through those magazines, and John Lewis said, yeah, I do remember that. He was part of Martin Luther King's entourage and marched in Selma.
And has the scars to prove it.
Exactly. At any rate, we had Zach Womp and John Lewis in the House. At that time, we had Senator Lamar Alexander and Senator Bill Frist,
right,
who was the majority leader in the Senate. We had some horsepower there. So we ended up receiving a grant to restore this building, and it was sizable and pure pork. We didn't have to match it.
That's great.
But at any rate, we said, uh-oh, you know, be careful what you wish for. You might get it. So here, when you got those kind of people giving you that kind of money to restore this building, we said, well, we got to do this right. So we went out and hired a design firm to do the interior design, which was a chore in itself because Steve Jones, as city manager, he kept calling design firms. And when they heard the story, they were all eager to do it. But this was like December of 2005. And we wanted to get this thing open by August of 2006, the 50th anniversary of the desegregation. And they said, oh, we'd love to do it, but we can't do it in that short period of time. And we finally found a firm, Eisterhold and Associates, in Kansas City, who agreed to do it. And if you go through here later, I'm sure you'll recognize they did a fantastic job.
You know what, Jerry? I'm going to suggest you and I stand up with our portable microphones, and we just do a quick walkthrough, and we at least briefly describe what's here.
So we just left the principal's office, and we've stepped into what looks like a classroom. Please tell me about it.
This is one of the two classrooms that existed back in the segregation period. The two classrooms for the 60 kids I told you about. And it's just like it was then. Same floor, same wall, same ceiling. Different lighting, of course. Mm-hmm. The desks were not the same desk, but similar from that era. And when people come to visit the museum, we first show them a chalk talk here, which gives a basic background of the Jim Crow era in the South and the beginning of the McSwain versus Anderson County lawsuit that led to the desegregation here in Clinton. And a little bit about that first attempt at desegregation. Back there in the back is an old typewriter. Mm-hmm. And that was a typewriter for the editor of the local weekly newspaper who won several national awards for his work editorializing and reporting during that period of time. There's a Rosa Parks Award that we received. Uh-huh. Here's an Emmy that was won by Cameron Boyce.
Yes.
He's a Disney star.
Right.
His mother, grandmother, is Joanne Allen Boyce, who was one of the original Clinton 12.
Right.
And he came here with the Disney crew and brought his grandmother. And they did a little 20-minute special on the Clinton 12 and the history of the desegregation. And it won an Emmy.
Very good.
So we're very, very proud of that.
Is that available online for people?
Yes, yes. Come to our website.
Come to your website.
Well, it's on YouTube.
Okay.
But you can link to it from our website.
What is your website, by the way?
Green McAdoo Cultural Center.
Okay, Green, just as it sounds, McAdoo, M-C-A-D-O-O.
Yes.
Cultural Center, all one word.
Yes.
Dot...
That's all you need to put in. You'll get it. You'll get it. Now, the second classroom here is composed of pictures from Life magazine and Time magazine blown up to life size. And the exhibit is set up in chronological order. Here, the first exhibit is an example of the hate literature that John Casper was distributing that first weekend that I mentioned. And here you can see the development of that situation. Incidentally, it might be of interest to you. Here's John Casper. He's a graduate of Columbia University.
Really?
Ran a bookstore in Greenwich Village.
Really?
Had a black girlfriend.
Something happened to him.
Yes, he came under the influence of Ezra Pound.
The poet and the Nazi sympathizer.
Correct, who was an extreme racist, anti-Semite. Here's a letter that John Casper wrote to Ezra Pound. Read that last paragraph there.
Master, you have saved us. You are the light in darkness. You have led us to air and water and the grain. You are the mighty. You are God and the greatest of all men. And this is all capitalized. You are master, sage, wisdom, power. You move all men to deeds that are wise and virtuous. That guy's disturbed.
Yes, well, that's John Casper. He came under the influence of Ezra Pound, and he was the instigator, along with Asa Carter, that I mentioned earlier, of the violence and mob violence we had that first week. And here's a picture of the principal I mentioned and different pictures inside the school that first week. And you can see the harassment that the mob inflicted on passengers coming through the U.S. highway, which was Main Street Clinton at that time. And, of course, we have these touch screens, and we have different members of the Clinton 12 making statements and responding. Here's a picture of that mob violence that first week. There's the Home Guard being sworn in, being instructed. Here's the mob that was downtown. There's where they threw the tear gas. But here you can see the National
Guard. That always striking from this era when the guard is called in, or the 101st Airborne.
Well, and this guardsman appears to be a black man.
Sure does.
And of course,
in fact, the fellow on the far left might be as well. Yeah. It's hard to tell.
Well, Harry Truman integrated the armed forces.
Yes.
One of the heavy lifters in this civil rights movement. But here's the platoon marching past the school. Here is that interim period, the kids walking to school after martial law was imposed. Here's discussion of the boycotts of businesses. And here is a picture of Reverend Turner walking the black kids down the hill that day in December that I mentioned earlier. This is Reverend Turner here. He's joined by a couple of these parishioners. I think that's a reporter there. Got to tell you a story about this gentleman.
Sure.
Sidney Davis.
Reporter?
Lawyer.
Lawyer, okay.
Local attorney. He defended Anderson County in the original lawsuit and presented the proof that Austin High School was equal to arguably superior, as I mentioned earlier in our interview, and successful. Mm-hmm. Now, after Brown versus Board was decided, he represented the proponents of desegregation. We always used to give him a hard time.
Right.
And he said, now, wait a minute. What you got to realize, I was right both times. Legally. And stand right back here.
Okay, stand right back here.
There's Clinton High School as it existed then.
And it's a pretty building. It's
very lovely building,
long brick building.
And there's a picture of it after the bombing.
Well, that is a very effective display. Your firm did a great job.
Well, we got a little...
That's almost the entire wall, and it just gets superimposed, the bombed-out building.
Right.
So, that's very dramatic. Yeah, you got to come see this for yourself.
Here's pictures of the aftermath of the bombing. And here's the Clinton kids coming to their old school to get back on the buses to caravan down to Oak Ridge. But there they are getting off the bus. There's the Oak Ridge band that met them.
Right. Wow.
And here's a picture of Bobby Kane, the first black to graduate. Beside him is Gail Ann Epps, the first female. She graduated the next year.
Right.
And we walk through here to the third room, which was added later. It was a cafeteria. Here's a picture of the Clinton 12, or part of the Clinton 12, who attended a meeting at the Highlander Center.
Right, the Social Activist Center.
Yeah. This was Christmas, that 1956 school year.
Right.
And Rosa Parks came up and talked to them.
Look at that. There she is.
We're not certain, but we think that's Rosa's mother there.
Oh, my. She looks like her.
Doesn't she, though?
She sure does.
Isn't that a great way to end my interview with Jerry Shattuck of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center, with Rosa Parks and perhaps her mother featured in one of the photographs? But this episode is not over yet, because there's one other person that you're going to hear from, and I'll let him tell his own story.
Who are you, and what do you do?
Robert Manley. I'm a retired Vermont prosecutor, and I live in Delta, Colorado, with my wife and grandchildren.
So you were a prosecutor up in Vermont?
I was.
Okay, so what's your connection to Tennessee?
All of my forebears lived within about 45 miles of Jefferson City, Tennessee, for a long time.
Which is just a bit east of Knoxville along I-40. Okay, I know the area well. Well, you're also a devoted listener to this program, and some years ago you sent me an email, didn't you?
I did.
What was in that email?
I don't recall, but the basic idea was that I thought that the story of the 1956 through 58, desegregation crisis in Clinton High School in Clinton, Tennessee, would make a wonderful subject for your program, Your Weekly Constitutional. And I urged you to become familiar with it in one way or another in my message. And
I did. That was several years back, and so I contacted them, and I think they were getting ready for a big anniversary or something. So this was probably 3 years ago. I guess that would be the 60th anniversary of it. And they were busy, and we just didn't set up the time, and I let the subject drop, and there were lots of other interviews to do. And so about a month ago, I get another email from you chastising me all the way from Colorado, where you've moved, and you said, well, I've looked, and you haven't done a podcast on this yet. And I said, you know, you're right. And so I thanked you again for reminding me, and I made arrangements, and I talked to Jerry Shattuck, and I got out here, and I was actually, even makes the story better, I was about 10 minutes late. And so because I was a little bit late, as literally Jerry and I were walking out the front door here for him to show me the front of the building, you came up and introduced yourself, and you told Jerry you were a big fan of his, right?
I did, and I am.
Right, and then I introduced myself, and you said, you're that guy from the radio show that I've been pestering. And I looked at you in absolute astonishment. This is a remarkable coincidence that you decided to come out here from Colorado and arrived at the same moment I did.
Yes, I'm here to visit my sister who is here with me today. She lives in Norris, Tennessee, just in the next door town to Clinton.
How many things had to happen at precisely the right moment for the two of us to shake hands on the front door of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center, I will never know. But it must mean something.
Must be in the cosmos somewhere. And I might say that this is the first time I've been in Tennessee in 6 years or so. So it's a big coincidence.
There must be some reason behind it. All right. Well, Robert, a real pleasure to meet you in person. And on behalf of all of the people listening now, thank you for pestering me to get back here to the Green McAdoo Cultural Center.
And thank you for pursuing the story of the heroes, black and white, at Clinton High School.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to both of our guests, Jerry Shattuck of the Green McAdoo Cultural Center and Robert Manley, who brought us together, perhaps guided by the cosmos. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.